Goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has adopted a resolution calling on Israel to be held accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Hours after US President Joe Biden told Israel to take concrete steps to protect civilians and aid workers in Gaza or risk losing military support from the United States, top members of President's Democratic Party ramped up pressure on the White House to go further. The progressive Senator Bernie Sanders was among the strongest voices. Bernie Sanders said Israel should not be getting another nickel in military aid until it markedly facilitates the flow of provisions into a region that the US suspects is already grappling with famine. Bernie Sanders told CNN on Thursday, 4th of April, "We're looking at one of the worst humanitarian disasters that we have seen in a very, very long time, because Israel is not allowing humanitarian trucks into Gaza, and especially into the areas where people are in most desperate condition." Sanders added it was not the US's job to worry about how Gaza may tie into the political future of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Vermont senator added, "My view is no more military aid to Israel when children are starving in Gaza." Meanwhile, the Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland insisted that President Biden enforce a national security memorandum signed in February that aimed to condition the transfer of military weaponry to Israel on its adherence to humanitarian benchmarks. Senator Van Hollen said topping the list of policies that President Biden could leverage against Israel is the suspension of transferring offensive weapons to the occupied Palestinian territories if it fails at reducing civilian harm or getting desperately needed assistance to people in need. Democratic Senator Van Hollen alluded to the policy days after Israeli airstrikes assassinated 7 employees of the international food charity World Central Kitchen. Following the attack, a cargo ship carrying 240 tons of food destined for Gaza returned to Cyprus. The The Democratic senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, said she would seek to impede the sale of F-15s to the occupied Palestinian territories after the assassination of the World Central Kitchen staffers, which included a US-Canadian citizen and three British nationals. A day before the World Central Kitchen workers were massacred, a report surfaced that the Biden administration was mulling an $18 billion arms transfer package to Israel that would include more than two dozen F-15 fighter jets. Democratic Senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, told CNN, "We cannot approve the sale of arms to a regime that is in violation of our own laws on this, and that includes access to humanitarian relief. This is a moral question, it is also a legal question. Congress has responsibility here, and I'm willing to take that responsibility." Bernie Sanders, Senators Van Hollen and Warren are all part of a 51-49 majority that Democrats and independents who caucus with them hold in the U.S. Senate. President Biden and his administration have generally stood in steadfast support of Israel, which has struck Gaza on land and by air after the 7th of October surprise operation by Hamas. But with the martyrdom toll in Gaza climbing above 30,000 and the humanitarian crisis worsening, the United States, which provides Israel with at least $3.8 billion in security assistance annually, recently abstained from a United Nations vote, which resulted in a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. President Biden on Thursday, 4th of April, for the first time called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza as well. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. World Central Kitchen has rejected as lacking credibility the findings of an Israeli investigation led by a former general into a coordinated series of Israeli drone strikes on the charity's vehicles in Gaza recently that assassinated seven aid workers. As the Israeli occupation forces blamed a series of grave errors for the deadly attack that assassinated three British nationals, three other foreign nationals, and a Palestinian colleague while delivering food, World Central Kitchen renewed its call for a full and independent inquiry into the incident. Amid mounting international pressure on the Israeli regime, the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said the findings of the Israeli inquiry, which he said the UK was reviewing carefully, showed that major reform was required. David Cameron said on X social media platform, "It's clear major reform of Israel's deconfliction mechanism is badly needed to ensure the safety of aid workers." The hurriedly completed inquiry, which led to two middle-ranking officers being dismissed and a general reprimanded in the Israeli army, outlined a catalogue of failings by Israeli forces in an attack that has reinforced global criticism of Israel's conduct of a war in which more than 33,000 Palestinians have been massacred in the past 6 months. While welcoming the report as a first step, the founder of World Central Kitchen, the celebrity chef Jose Andres, said the Israeli military cannot credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza. It's not enough to simply try to avoid further humanitarian deaths, which have now approached close to 200. All civilians need to be protected and all innocent people in Gaza need to be fed and safe, and all captives must be released. The charity's chief executive, Erin Gore, said, "Their apologies for the outrageous massacring of our colleagues represent cold comfort. It's cold comfort for the victims' families and World Central Kitchen's global family. Israel needs to take concrete steps to assure the safety of humanitarian aid workers. Our operations remain suspended in Gaza." World Central Kitchen's remarks were echoed by the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, who said fixing failings in Israel's military procedures required independent investigations and meaningful and measurable changes on the ground, noting that 196 humanitarian aid workers have been assassinated during Israel's brutal assault on Gaza. Antonio Guterres said, We want to know why. The announcement of punishments and the apology have not calmed the international outcry over the World Central Kitchen workers' deaths or reassured international aid groups that it is safe to resume operations in Gaza, where nearly a third of the population is on the brink of starvation. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The United Nations Human Rights Council has adopted a resolution calling for Israel to be held accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the Gaza Strip. The resolution came as Israel finally succumbed to unprecedented US pressure and opened new food corridors into Gaza. The vote by the United Nations Human Rights Council, a body that Israel reviles, marks another moment in the slow global ostracization of Israel over its war in Gaza, which has so far massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians. 28 countries voted in favor, 13 countries abstained from the vote, and 6 voted against the resolution, including the United States and Germany. The resolution emphasized the need to ensure accountability for all violations of international humanitarian law and international human rights law in order to end impunity. It also expressed grave concern at reports of serious human rights violations and grave breaches of international humanitarian law, including of possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in the occupied Palestinian territories. The resolution follows what appears to have been a decisive phone call between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu on Thursday, 4th of April, in which Joe Biden warned US policy towards Gaza would change if Israel continued to defy calls to alter its approach to the supply of aid to the population of Gaza.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be asking why the Zionist lobby and US warmongers are so exercised by who owns TikTok. Latif Abu Chakra has discovered some surprising information about who TikTok has appointed to influential positions within the company. And she's filed this report.
A combination of US warmongers and Israel lobbyists are pushing the idea that because TikTok is owned by a Chinese company, it must be spying on and manipulating young people into, amongst other supposedly deplorable things, supporting Palestinians against genocidal Zionism. Well, TikTok, rather than being a hub of Chinese espionage, seems to be packed to the rafters with former US intelligence and NATO employees. Content policy lead for TikTok Canada, Alexander Corbeil, is simultaneously the vice president of the NATO Association of Canada. Aiche Kochak spent 3 years at NATO before becoming global product policy manager at the company at TikTok. Feature policy manager Greg Anderson worked on psychological operations for NATO until 2019. Bo Pateson has been working as a threat analyst for TikTok's Trust and Safety Division. Previously, Pateson was a targeting analyst for the CIA. Victoria Makolo previously worked for the Department of Homeland Security and for the White House. She now works on trust and safety at TikTok. There are many more. The latest escalation on TikTok began in the early stages of Israel's Gaza genocide, when a recording of Jonathan Greenblatt, head of the lobby group and spy agency ADL, was leaked. In it, he lamented what he called the Gen Z and TikTok problems. This was a clear signal that the genocide lobby was joining the anti-TikTok campaign. Now the US Congress has issued a warning that TikTok must be purchased by a US company within 6 months or be banned from the country. Pro-Israel former Trump official Steve Mnuchin is gathering investors under his umbrella to buy TikTok. It is unclear if the investors will include his close friend, Yossi Cohen, former director of Mossad, whom Mnuchin previously asked to join his other investment fund for Arab states. If the US was concerned about espionage against it and the protection of data, surely Larry Ellison's Oracle would not store key classified Defense Department data. Ellison did, after all, offer Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the directorship of the company, and is also one of the largest donors to the Israeli occupation forces in history. Nancy Pelosi even went so far on CNN as to state that Benjamin Netanyahu attempted to interfere in the US elections. The United States does have a threat to its sovereignty, but it isn't from China.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's AM University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is the celebrated British-Iraqi hip-hop artist Loki. He hosts the Watchdog podcast for Mint Press News that investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. He's also a regular contributor on other media outlets like Double Down News. In recent years, he's gained a reputation as a cerebral commentator on international affairs in general and the crisis in Palestine in particular. And he's joining us today from London via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, why is it, do you think, that who owns TikTok it sort of enrages both the United States hawks and the Israelis so much?
Well, the main reason, of course, is because young people use it, and young people are, in particular, virulently pro-Palestine, and yeah. That's what they don't like. They can't stand the fact that that overwhelmingly, if you look at TikTok, the messages that you get are pro-Palestine. There's hardly any, by comparison, pro-Israel messages, despite the best efforts, one, of the Israelis in trying to flood it with messages, and two, TikTok itself in trying to regulate the algorithm. So it's because they are losing on TikTok. So, of course, they have to find a way to explain that, and the way that they explain that is to say, oh, it's the Chinese. Chinese doing this. No, it's not the Chinese. We know it's the State Department people who are running it. The people from the high echelons of the American national security apparatus are in there. It's been shown conclusively. So what they don't want is for there to be a massive outpouring of pro-Palestine content on social media, and they can't regulate it because it's done by young people who they don't understand and can't control.
And yet they've said, haven't they, that it's got to be bought by an American company, haven't they?
It's already not owned by a Chinese company. The whole thing is an absurdity.
Yeah, it's really strange, isn't it? Anyway, but Loki, it's not only those supporting Palestine, is it, who actually use TikTok?
Well, Israel now finds itself in an interesting position because on one hand, it incentivized and encouraged its soldiers to do TikTok videos, quote unquote, thirst trap videos to try and beautify the image of the Israeli occupation forces. But what that led to also was Israeli military personnel sharing evidence of their own war crimes on the app, which were then entered into the ICJ submission for South Africa. And so in a way, it's a double-edged sword for Israel. On the other hand, what they also saw was people across the world using it to unpick the propaganda that Israel was pumping into the atmosphere. And TikTok, it was argued by Israel lobbyists, was somehow advantaging or algorithmically encouraging pro-Palestinian content, when actually those that attempt to use TikTok will find quite the opposite is true. Many pro-Palestinian accounts have been banned from TikTok with very little explanation.
Well, David, I mean, Latifa there mentioned the Anti-Defamation League in her report, otherwise known as the ADL. I mean, this organisation, we've mentioned it on the show numerous occasions, I mean, they pop up all over the place, don't they?
Well, I mean, people talk about how AIPAC buys political candidates in the US. Well, yeah. The AIPAC isn't the only element of the Israel lobby. The ADL is a key element, has been for over a century now.
Yeah.
And it's a spy agency. It's there to spy on pro-Palestine protesters or Muslims or anyone who is critical of the state of Israel, and sometimes even those who were critical of the state of South Africa under apartheid were spied upon by the ADL. So it's there to sabotage pro-Palestine movements. And, of course, it's what it's doing in relation to TikTok. It's trying to encourage this idea that this is a Chinese company or that it's too pro-Palestine and to try and undermine it. So it's the spy wing, the sort of open spy wing of the Israel lobby in the US.
Well, Loki, what kind of methods then did the ADL use to pressure TikTok?
I think it's important to understand that the line is not clear where the ADL begins and the US security state ends. So the ADL is very much a product, though it has far deeper roots, of course, but in its present manifestation, a product of the bilateral security state between the US and Israel. It has a revolving door between it and the FBI. Several high-ranking figures in the ADL have come directly out of the FBI. And in fact, James Comey, at the time the head of the FBI, said the relationship between them and the ADL has never been closer. The ADL is actually the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US. But the way that they mobilized around TikTok was very interesting. They made use of well-known Hollywood Islamophobe Sacha Baron Cohen, who has for many years been involved in the making of films which have buttressed the stereotypes that alienate Muslims across the Western world. But they mobilized him and sent him to TikTok to try and bully the platform and threaten them with this allegation that TikTok was responsible for the greatest increase in anti-Semitism since the Nazi regime of World War II. Patently false, complete rubbish. And of course, the ADL benefits from very close relationships with the creme de la creme of Hollywood and US celebrity, the US celebrity world. But they are also in a situation where they are becoming increasingly desperate when faced with the wave of pro-Palestinian feeling in the shadow of the Zionist genocide in Gaza.
Mm. Well, of course, the ADL were involved in a similar shakedown, weren't they, against Elon Musk?
Yeah, there was a sort of backwards and forwards, wasn't there? They sort of threatened Elon Musk with this advertiser boycott, and the advertising revenues precipitously declined. And Musk then went to Israel with Netanyahu and came back and said he was very impressed by all that and then started to make moves in the Zionist direction. But he also said that he wasn't going to give in to this advertiser boycott, no, which he was meaning the ADL's boycott. And there was a sort of another bit of to and fro, and then, of course, he gave in, and there've been various signs that they are that X, or Twitter as it used to be called, have been giving in to Zionist demands and implementing those demands across the platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Loki, I mean, how does all this fit into the wider war against China then?
Well, the United States has 400 military bases situated around China. It has US forces on an island controlled by Taiwan that is just a few miles from the Chinese border. They have been constantly elevating the propaganda against China in the US media, and they have been seeking to take measures to build sacrificial lambs throughout the West. Of course, China is the number one trading partner for the vast majority of Western countries, including this one and including the United States. What this is about is the US being the number one producer in the world for over 100 years, and then that mantle moving to the Chinese. But of course, we have to remember that before the founding of the East India Company and the initiation of the British Empire, which spanned at its zenith over 14 million square miles of the planet, both China and India represented a far, far, an exponentially larger percentage of global production than the United States or Britain ever did. And so actually the British Empire established a sort of disfigured global order in which this tiny place was able to use other territories in the world, not only for captive labor, but also for free resources and also captive markets. And so it was that way that you had the development of Anglo-Saxon supremacy throughout the world. But China is pushing back the clock on all of that, and the world is returning to a more natural economic equilibrium. So the United States is doing everything it can to try and push that back with the US military industrial complex leading the way. So TikTok fits in very clearly into that order of events, and it is really swept up as a moral panic, this idea of TikTok corrupting children, for one, but also to TikTok supposedly being a site of foreign espionage.
No, indeed. Well, look, we'll come back to our discussion in a moment, because we've got another report now about TikTok's links to a pro-Israel company, which in turn is linked to the CIA.
The idea that China is spying on US citizens via TikTok becomes even more ridiculous when you discover that the data gathered by the company in the United States has actually been diverted to pro-Israel CIA cutout company Oracle as part of a massive deal known as Project Texas. The Oracle company was founded by Larry Ellison in 1977. The firm adopted the name of a CIA operation, and the first service it provided was helping the intelligence agency build a database. Oracle later hired David Carney to head its Information Assurance Center. Carney had previously been the third highest ranked employee at the CIA, where he had worked for 32 years. Today, Oracle is the world's second biggest IT software company, and Larry Ellison is the seventh richest person in the world. He is still the top shareholder in Oracle and works as the chief technology officer, as well as sitting as the executive chairman of the company, despite passing the role of CEO to Israeli Safra Katz. Larry Ellison was also instrumental in Elon Musk's bid to buy Twitter, providing him with $1 billion to pursue his takeover. Less well known is the closeness of Ellison and, in fact, the whole company to Israel. Over a period of a decade, Ellison donated over $26 million to the Israeli military. The current CEO of Oracle has explicitly stated the company's pro-Israel bias. Safra Katz exclaimed, "We're not flexible regarding our mission, and our commitment to Israel is second to none. If our employees don't agree with our mission to support the state of Israel, then maybe we aren't the right company for them. Larry and I are publicly committed to Israel." The extent of the company's relationship with Israel is even more clearly seen in the report that Ellison even offered Netanyahu the position of director at Oracle. Project Texas also led to an influx of agents from the US security state into TikTok, like Rebecca Pober, who went from her post at the Pentagon to become a US policy manager at TikTok. The company's head of data public policy for Europe is Jade Nestor, who was the State Department's Director of Internet Public Policy. Another interesting individual at TikTok is recruiting coordinator Katrina Villacisneros, who was part of Army Cyber Command, the US military unit that oversees information warfare online.
I see Larry Ellison was mentioned in that report there, David. Just say a word or two, will you, about him and his links to Israel.
Well, you couldn't make this up, could you? I mean, this is the seventh richest person in the world who is the runs the second biggest IT firm in the world. And the company says that it will not even tolerate employees who think differently about the Zionist entity. And they can go elsewhere and work for another company. And the process by which they are involving themselves with TikTok is the process that they've done in many other companies. They have massive contracts, of course, in the UK as well. And what we see then is that the data which they are managing for in these contracts are this data which is, you know, which is clearly available to Israeli intelligence. So this is a massive, massive scandal. And whenever we talk about this kind of thing, people say, "Oh, this is nothing." But this is a real scandal. That actually, this is an Israeli intelligence operation to penetrate the data systems of the largest organizations in the world, including governmental organizations, which have a national security component. Mm. The fact that they're now penetrating TikTok as well as many other companies, and that they're putting in place people who are ex-US spies and from the US national security apparatus is truly astonishing. But, you know, you won't find this in the mainstream media at all.
Mm. I was going to say, where is the corporate media then?
Nowhere.
How would you explain that? I mean, it's very odd, isn't it?
That's a much longer answer you asked me to do. But you know, the media, of course, are structurally opposed
as we've actually touched on in previous shows. But Loki, how does Oracle then go about obtaining contracts in here in the UK?
Well, the interesting thing about Larry Ellison is that he is also a component of the campaign against Elon Musk and Twitter, because, of course, he borrowed Elon Musk $1 billion in order to buy the platform. In addition to that, Larry Ellison is so close to Benjamin Netanyahu that even though Ellison is supposed to be a prosecution witness in the eternally delayed corruption trial that Netanyahu must undergo when he's finished genociding Gaza, Ellison has met with Netanyahu several times on his private Hawaiian island, and he even saw to it that his own lawyer and the lawyer of Israeli intelligence agent Arnon Milchan, another supposedly prosecution witness in the trial, was given to Benjamin Netanyahu for the trial. So all manner of corruption and conflict of interest seem to be at play here. In terms of domestically, Oracle stores the data for the British Ministry of Defence, for the Home Office, for the British Foreign Office, and even for the British National Health Service. Now, the very month that Larry Ellison's company obtained this massive contract with the British government, you had the cancelling of Larry Ellison's Ellison Foundation charity, which operated here and employed the father-in-law of Boris Johnson, who was at the time the Prime Minister, as its head. And, you know, Boris Johnson's father-in-law received £500,000 wage per year from Larry Ellison's charity, at the same time that Ellison was employing other British government high-ranking employees. At the same time, he was vying for a contract from the British government. To me, that's an open and shut case of conflict of interest.
Well, a bit of a rhetorical question now then, David, but do you think any of the data that we've discussed is safe in the hands of Larry Ellison and Oracle?
Well, I mean, from the outside, you can say that obviously people will be sceptical of that.
Yeah,
But you know, what do we have? Do we have any kind of due diligence from the Ministry of Defence, from the Foreign Office, from the Home Office? These are, of course, the three government departments in the UK which are responsible for all of the intelligence operations of the British state, for GCHQ, MI5, MI6, and all the rest of the military intelligence as well. So this is an open and shut case of a national security problem, which the national security establishment of the UK steadfastly refuses to face. Mm-hmm. It simply won't look at it, and you've had what effectively are massive bribes to senior civil servants, and indeed to the former the Prime Minister's father-in-law. I mean, this is an extraordinary situation. Mm. There should be a public inquiry on this in the UK, but there's not a whiff of it anywhere in public debate.
No, indeed. So, I mean, it's not only the media falling down on the job, but the political politicians who are supposed to be holding these sort of organisations to account.
And the intelligence agencies. The intelligence agencies should be leading an investigation of this.
Sure, indeed. Well, Loki, I mean, are we seeing an antagonism developing, do you think, in the relationship between China and Israel?
Well, this is a fascinating question, Chris, because immediately after October 7th, the Chinese government refused to condemn the operation. In addition to that, Israel, since the beginning of its genocidal campaign in Gaza, has charged that China is unofficially operating sanctions against Israel on the dual-use civil and military exports, which normally are sent from China to Israel because they just haven't been coming in. Now, supposedly, there is a bureaucratic reason behind it, but Israel is convinced that China is targeting it. In addition to that, when Israel cancelled the work permits of 65,000 Palestinian construction workers in the aftermath of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, what you saw was Israel seeking to fill that gap with 100,000 Chinese workers. The Chinese government then banned its citizens from going and working in Israel. We know that around 30,000 Chinese citizens were working in the Zionist entity prior to October 7th. At least 20,000 of them have left. And what we also know is that during this time, perhaps as revenge for the unofficial sanctions issue, you have seen the Israeli port of Haifa, which previously was controlled by a Shanghai corporation. The Chinese had invested a huge amount of resource in developing the Haifa port. It's now, during this period, fell 70% under the control of an Indian billionaire. So there certainly is some level of antagonism developing within the Israel and China dynamic, for sure.
Well, David, I mean, what sort of impact then do you think there would be with a kind of fallout in the relationship between China and Israel in the region there?
Well, we already know what some of the impacts have been. We already know that the Chinese brokered the deal between Iran and the Saudis, which also helped to end the conflict in Yemen,
yeah,
and put Israel in the position of being able to enforce a boycott of an embargo on the Red Sea. We already know that the Chinese have been behind the overtures between the Syrian government and the Saudis, and indeed by Hamas and the Saudis, and indeed with Hezbollah and the Saudis. These are all massive changes in the region, which mean that the region is moving away from having to separately fight Israel, and indeed are moving in a direction which means that China will increasingly become to be seen on the side of what effectively is the resistance axis. Now, it's not doing that openly as yet, but the overtures it's making are having the consequence that actually fighting between the Arab nations is being decreased, and that of course means that there will be probably an increased confrontation with the Zionist entity.
Another indication, perhaps, of the end of the unipolar world and the emergence of the multipolar world, something we'll probably have to come back to on another show, because unfortunately we are right out of time for today. So thank you to our guest, Lo Ki, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when Palestine Declassified, we'll be back with more forensic investigations and analysis. This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas has denounced Texas Governor Greg Abbott's efforts to fortify stretches of the southern border with Mexico with razor and concertina wire. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper Punkchester Times has covered this story and tells us more. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas criticized Texas Governor Greg Abbott's initiative to reinforce sections of the southern border with Mexico with concertina and razor wire, labeling the approach ineffective. Alejandro Mayorkas, speaking at a roundtable at Homeland Security headquarters in Washington on Friday, 5th of April, highlighted that migrants were easily cutting through the barriers, impairing the ability of Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to carry out their duties. Texas Governor Greg Abbott's strategy under the umbrella of Operation Lone Star and involving the deployment of state National Guard troops includes the installation of concertina and razor wire alongside other barriers along Texas's border with Mexico. This has sparked a legal dispute between Texas and the U.S. Justice Department, particularly regarding the use of such wire. Contrary to Governor Abbott's claims attributing reduced illegal crossings to the barriers, Alejandro Mayorkas pointed out that certain border sections were fortified with razor wire last year, when migrant crossings were at record highs. He argued that crediting the decrease in encounters solely to Governor Abbott's measures is unfounded, emphasizing the complex nature of border security. Under Governor Greg Abbott's leadership, Texas has pursued an aggressive stance challenging federal authority over border and immigration policy. Alongside deploying barriers and National Guard troops, Texas has engaged in controversial actions like transporting migrants to Democratic-led cities without prior notification. Additionally, Texas has attempted to implement stringent immigration laws, exemplified by SB 4, which is currently subject to legal scrutiny. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas accused Texas of exacerbating disorder through its border efforts, emphasizing the importance of coordination between federal and state authorities in addressing immigration issues. He stressed that immigration policy falls within the exclusive purview of the federal government, reiterating the need for responsible governance in addressing border challenges. Despite facing impeachment proceedings in the House of Representatives related to his handling of immigration policy, Alejandro Mayorkas remains focused on his duties. As he prepares to testify before congressional committees, Mayorkas underscored his commitment to his work, expressing hope that the impeachment process would not detract from his responsibilities at Homeland Security Department. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Friday, 5th of April, denounced Texas Governor Greg Abbott's efforts to fortify stretches of the southern border with Mexico with razor and concertina wire as ineffective, saying migrants are easily cutting through the barriers. "We do not consider concertina wire to be effective. It impairs Customs and Border Protection's ability to do its job. And we're also seeing migrants rather easily cutting through concertina wire," Mayorkas told a group of reporters who attended a roundtable on Friday, 5th of April, at Homeland Security headquarters in Washington. As part of a broader, multi-billion-dollar campaign known as Operation Lone Star, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has instructed state National Guard troops to put up concertina and razor wire, as well as other barriers along parts of Texas's border with Mexico. The wire is currently at the center of an ongoing legal battle in federal courts of law between Texas and the U.S. Justice Department. Governor Greg Abbott argues that the barriers deter migrants from crossing into his state illegally and has credited them for a marked drop in illegal crossings along the Texas border since last year. More broadly, he has claimed that Texas actions, which also include arrests of migrants on trespassing charges, are responsible for pushing migrant crossings into neighboring Arizona and California in recent months. But Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas disputed Governor Abbott's claims on Friday, 5th of April, noting that some stretches of the Texas-Mexico border were fortified with razor wire late last year, when migrant crossings were soaring to record levels, including in the Texas border town of Eagle Pass. "I know that Governor Greg Abbott has taken credit for a reduction in the number of encounters, and I would posit that the tools that he has employed, and I'm not commenting on their lawfulness or legal shortcomings, that is obviously the subject of litigation in court, but the tools that he has employed were in effect in December, and they were in effect in January, Mayorkas said. And so to attribute the significant drop in the number of encounters to anything he has done, I would say, is belied by the facts. Representatives for Texas Governor Greg Abbott did not immediately respond for requests for comment. During Governor Greg Abbott's tenure, Texas has mounted the most aggressive state effort in modern history to challenge the federal government's long-standing power to set border and immigration policy. In addition to trespassing arrests and the deployment of barriers and National Guard troops, Texas has bused tens of thousands of migrants to Democratic-led cities without notifying local authorities. Last January, the Texas National Guard commandeered a public park in Eagle Pass, Texas, and has since blocked federal Border Patrol agents from processing migrants there. Texas has also sought to implement one of the toughest state immigration laws in U.S. history. The measure, known as SB 4, would empower Texas officials to arrest and jail migrants on misdemeanor or felony charges if they are suspected of crossing into the United States without authorization and to order them to return to Mexico. The law is currently paused while a federal appeals court determines its legality. Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas said he couldn't say much about SB 4 because of the ongoing court case, but he noted that it is federal government's position that immigration policy is the exclusive province of the federal government. Alejandro Mayorkas accused Texas of trying to create disorder through its border efforts. "We think that responsible governance requires people in positions of authority to communicate, to coordinate and collaborate with one another, and the deliberate refusal to do so in an effort to sow chaos is not responsible governance." Alejandro Mayorkas, who came to the U.S. as a child refugee from Cuba, has found himself at the center of the nation's contentious debate over immigration policy. It's a debate that has intensified in recent years because of record levels of migrant apprehensions reported along the southern border with Mexico. Earlier this year, the Republican-led House of Representatives impeached Alejandro Mayorkas on charges that he breached the public's trust and failed to fully enforce U.S. immigration laws, making him the first cabinet secretary to be impeached since the 1870s. Alejandro Mayorkas has not been accused of personal misconduct, and Democrats have said Republicans impeached him solely because of immigration policy differences. The House impeachment managers are expected to deliver the articles of impeachment to the Democratic-led Senate next Wednesday, when Mayorkas is also set to testify before two congressional committees for funding hearings. On Friday, 5th of April, Mayorkas reiterated that he remains focused on his day job and said he hasn't thought about whether he'd prefer that the Senate hold a trial or quickly dismiss the impeachment articles against him.
Ya estamos de regreso para seguir las conversaciones que hemos tenido.
We are now back to continue the conversation we had to learn about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. Today I invite you to talk with Valentina Salvador Huagui, a Chilean doctor of Palestinian origin, who has been working recently since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza with a group of doctors to try to help. Let's learn a little bit more about Valentina through the following video.
Un poco más sobre Valentina.
Valentina Salvador es nieta de palestinos.
Valentina Salvador is the granddaughter of Palestinians. She studied medicine and is a specialist in surgeries for oncological diseases. She learned the love of cooking from her grandmother, and grew up with recipes that she still continues to prepare and that connect her with the cultural traditions of her homeland. In 2017, she traveled to Palestine as part of a program that brought together the diaspora from different continents. She returned with the memory of a kind, happy and welcoming people who enjoyed life with simplicity despite the tensions of the occupation, the wall, and the many shortcomings. As part of the Doctors' Society of Palestine, where some 300 specialists participate, they began to pressure scientific societies to play a more active role and denounce the genocide. The events, however, have led them to continue their work raising funds to send medical supplies through the Chilean embassy in Egypt. Valentina believes that not only is the lack of food and water serious, the treatments that were left unfinished, the lack of vaccines and the lack of medical care in short are also other slow and silent ways of exterminating the Palestinian nation.
Hello
Valentina, thank you very much for accepting our invitation. You are third generation. On what date and for what reasons do your parents migrate here?
Acerca la llegada de tus padres.
I'm sorry, your grandparents.
De mis abuelos, sí. Daniel, muchas gracias por la invitación. Un honor.
Well, of course, my grandparents. Daniel, thank you very much for the invitation. It is an honor to be here representing the Doctors of Palestine. Look, my family on both sides come more or less before the Nakba. It was mainly as a result of the persecutions by the Ottoman Empire. For example, my family name is Salvador. My grandfather arrived in Chile around 1910. Several of his children were born in Betlalal, but my grandfather was born here in Chile, in the town of Catamu, where they settled upon their arrival in Chile. On the other hand, in depth, my grandfather's wife, Victoria Issa, came to Chile directly from Palestine. Around 1929-1930, my grandfather's father arrived here with them, and from there, in the bottom line, the family has settled in this land.
Aquí hay dos eventos que es importante destacar.
Here there are two events that are important to highlight. It was around the First World War that the Palestinians arrived. Turkish Ottoman Empire decided for the first time to force the inhabitants to defend the empire in any possible wars that might arise. And they began, for the first time, to recruit the firstborn children, the eldest of each family. And that makes many Christians and also Jews send their children out of Palestine to avoid taking them to the war. In the case of the grandmother, she surely came because of the great general strike of the 29th, where the colonization process had already begun, and we were at the gates of the Nakba, but the Nakba was already planned. This is very interesting because this also generates surely the same thing that happened in your family. A generational gap. The children of that do not have much of a relationship with Palestine. They do not pass on the language, for example. And it is always the third generation that recovers Palestinianity. What was that process like? What was it that set it off? And what are you up to today?
¿Qué fue lo que lo detonó y en qué estás hoy día?
Mira, tal cual como tú dices.
Look, just like you say, it happens to me also. Well, obviously, in my parents' house, they spoke an Arabic language. And being born in Chile, they kind of had to recover everything because in Chile, things were a little different. It's just like you say, they kind of experienced Palestine in the house.
Cosa que para nosotros fue diferente.
Something that was different for us. I think I get emotional because of the topic, sorry. But I think I have returned to it. I come from a school with a lot of social sense, a lot of politics. I don't think I had ever questioned it, like where it comes from. But yes, I think it was my dad who instilled it into me. Regardless of the fact that I seldom spoke, there was always these Palestinian things in my house. Always, always. Everything had to do with it. Food, traditions. And I think this provoked my sense of curiosity to investigate what this Palestinian thing they were talking about is. So I started to investigate, to learn from history. When people spoke to me, I like to have information and tell them what this is, what Palestine is, what is happening, because they asked me at school. Deep down, there was an important Palestinian group that would talk about the issue of Palestine, and sometimes I felt like I had to participate in such arguments. The Palestinian issue always resonated in my head. It's good. It catches my attention because I'm the most Palestinian-like person in my generation.
In fact, you are the first to travel to Palestine.
Exactly. In 2017, I said that I really have to go. I have to see what happens. And in addition to being the most beautiful trip of my life, at the same time, it is also a very powerful trip. Encountering this reality of injustice and encountering this reality of their everyday lives are really heartbreaking. And it is sad because they are very good people, a good nation, but in the end, they are having a hard time on a daily basis. And they are used to it. They have normalized this. I have friends who have instilled resistance into their lives. They don't have the possibility of being seen. I have a group of friends who are actually marathoners called Right to Movement. And they were in Chile here recently. And the truth is that I kind of see in them a hope of getting out of this. But in the end, there is no great help for them to achieve this hope.
There's a question that I always ask here because not many people understand it. When I took my first trip, I had a very special feeling, and I want to know if you felt the same thing and how you experienced it, because here you were actually returning to a place where you have never been to.
Yes, it's very strange.
Three different facets of the Zionist project. First, some Israeli citizens are enjoying watching the genocide from a hill in the occupied territories and cheering their army doing what the Nazis did with them. It is as if it were a film made in Hollywood. Second, we see an Israeli project, a real estate project to be located in the Gaza Strip, a coastal area oriented towards the north and with tourist potential, highly desired by Western imperialists. Third, we see images of the Nakba and all the destruction and this whole plan known as the Plan Dalet to expel about 700,000 Palestinians, destroying 500 villages, and the life, history, and geography of those who had lived in this territory for centuries. But let's see the story on the maps to see the evolution of this, to see if, indeed, as Finkelstein said, what happened on October 7th justifies what came afterwards. Does what has happened in the last 75 years justify the complete dismantling of a fascist and neo-colonial regime like that of Israel? This is Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century, where Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists lived together without any problem and in absolute peace and brotherhood, with a proportion of the Jewish population close to 5%. Shortly after, in the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, Theodor Herzl, recognized as the father of contemporary Zionism, presented his project called the Jewish State to form a Jewish national home in Palestine. Of course, the lobby carried out throughout the West, and with the main powers of the time allowing them to achieve in 1917 the Balfour Declaration, known as the formal beginning of the Palestinian tragedy. Great Britain, the current England, without having any right to do so, committed themselves to the Zionist organization and to give Palestine a group of foreigners coming from all over the world. This declaration was put into practice by an illegal immigrant that sought to change things on the ground and change the proportion of the population. In 1947, the population of Jewish religion was about 30%, but above religion, the Zionist population came in, but not only as refugees seeking support, but to start the programs of Tsarist Russia and also the Nazi Holocaust. They came to usurp everything. They made the newly born United Nations, which had been created from the failure of the Society of Nations, approved the partitions of Palestine, an organization that was established to protect the right of self-determination of the people, approved the partition of Palestine. And guess who were not invited to the meeting? The Palestinians. That is, in complete absence of the main owners of the land, they gave 55% of historical Palestine to the Zionist organization, and 44% divided into three unconnected zones to the Palestinians. Clearly, there was no possibility that either of these two states would be consolidated as they were intended. Obviously, the Palestinians rejected, but Zionism also rejected it and advanced in the war of 1948 until it occupied 78% of historical Palestine in 1980. What we know today as occupied territory remained in the hands of Jordan and Egypt, but this lasted about 20 years until the war of 1967, where Israel made use of its great military power and its always strong support from the Western powers, and mainly from the United States, from Europe and Germany, tried to pay the blame for the Nazi Holocaust with Palestinian blood. They advanced on the entire territories and on the heights of the Syrian Golan and a strip of Lebanese territories that remained occupied for more than two decades. Today, after years of extermination, after years of a genocidal policy on the parts of Israel with the Oslo Agreement, the Palestinian territories are reduced to a 15%, and also in the form of small